You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we are in Bardonecchia.
I'm happy, the ride was crazy. The plan was crazy, the world day was crazy, and it was a kind of black belt situation, but...
Did Chris tell you that he wanted you to set him up in the way that he did at that point in the race?
Yeah, when I passed my turn, he told me faster, 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 and I was like, whoa, the climb is really long, but my race is finished then, so I went fast, and I was surprised he went to go so fast with...
So long, but
yeah, he did something really very special today.
Where are we, Daniel?
Well, amazing scenes, Rich, because we're in a bar in Bardonecchia, which I was last in 2014. And do you know who else was here that day, just on the table next to me?
Yes, I do, because you told me a few minutes ago.
Is it in any way relevant to today's stage? It is slightly relevant. It was David Walsh and the Team Sky, then Team Sky doctor, Richard Freeman. It's slightly relevant to the reaction to today's stage, because I know some people will have seen Chris Froome pull off one of the rides of the century. I mean, this century is only 18 years old.
I think the last two centuries.
Well, and people will feel slightly uneasy.
They will, but we heard at the start there from his teammate Kenny Ellison, who put in a pretty incredible ride himself to set Chris Froome up for his attack. About 7 or 8 kilometres from the top of the Finestre, Froome took off. It was 80 kilometres of the stage still to go. And you were among the people looking at that, shaking your head, wondering what on earth was going on.
Yeah, I thought he was too greedy. I thought at that point he should have been dealing with one adversary at a time. He'd only just dealt with Simon Yates, and he sort of moved along the line and was preoccupied with taking Tom Dumoulin out of the race as well, which I didn't think he needed to do. I thought there were enough interests in the small group that he was in. There were enough people who were keen to, well, at that point, distance Domenico Pozzovivo, who was losing ground, and that he could have surfed that group.
Are you saying he got it wrong?
Well, he could have used them in the valley, and he probably would have been 20 minutes ahead tonight.
Chris Froome got that all wrong today. Terrible tactics. I don't think we called that. However, we did play an interview a couple of days ago with Brent Copeland, where he pretty much predicted exactly what would happen today. He was very worried about Froome and Sky based on the time trial, actually. But we also, I think, have been saying, perhaps not about Chris Froome, but a rider we haven't mentioned yet, Simon Yates, the pink jersey who cracked horribly today.
Well, we did say that Froome was probably going to be the guy who would like the blue touch paper. I think we said yesterday, even if it wasn't him who ultimately ended up with the pink jersey. And that's exactly what happened. We talked about the fact that Froome had nothing to lose, really, from the position that he was in. And I just didn't expect him to go that long. And we also didn't expect the group that we knew would go down the road, a big group with Sky represented, Sunweb represented. We didn't think they'd be caught as early as they were. We thought that Froome would be able to maybe use a teammate in the next valley before the Sestriere climb. He didn't need a teammate. Can you remember the 2005 Giro? I was talking about this to JP, our Belgian colleague, today. So the Finestre was crucial there. It was the crucial stage. Paolo Savoldelli won the Giro, and he relied on the help of a rider from another team, Wim van Huffel. Whatever became of Wim van Huffel in the valley after the Finestre? But Froome didn't need anyone, did he?
Let's, without further ado, get the tail of the tapper. Lionel will be listening at home. He'll be getting very upset that we've not had the tail of the tapper. Yeah, let's have that now. So stage 19 from Venaria Real to Bardonecchia, the second of 3 big days in the Alps. There was a fast start to the stage, and there had been some anxiety at the start because it was obvious that Sky, Sunweb and Mitchelton we'd all try to get riders in the break. But 40 kilometres into the stage and nothing had stuck yet. Fabio Aru abandoned at about 41 kilometres, the local favourite. Sort of miserable Giro, and he was out. Vasil Kirianka, strong rider for Team Sky, abandoned at the same point. Meanwhile, a 10-man group formed. Luis Leon Sanchez was there, of course he was, but more dangerously, Sergio Henao and David De La Cruz were there for Team Sky. Lawrence Tendam was there for Team Sunweb. Seven men joined them, including our old friend Joe Dombrowski, but the gap never really grew to much more than a minute. It was fast for the first 2 hours, 42.6 kilometres, and then they were onto the slopes of the Colle delle Finestre with the gap at 110. Some riders began to drift back on the climb, and among them, surprisingly, shockingly, was Simon Yates, the pink jersey. Sky, meanwhile, were drilling it at the front, and Yates was soon distanced. With 81 kilometres still to race and about 7 kilometres of the mountain still left, Kenny Ellison of Team Sky went to the front, rode really hard, and Chris Froome launched his attack. Nobody reacted. Under all this pressure, Domenico Pozzovivo, third at the start of the day, was in difficulty too, and he began to slip back. The gap was never more than about 40 seconds. It hovered between 25 and 40 seconds, but Froome gained almost a minute on the descent of the Finestre. And on the descent, Tom Dumoulin, Thibaut Pinot, Sebastian Reichenbach, Richard Carapaz, and Miguel Angel Lopez came together to form a chasing group. By this point, Yates was almost 15 minutes down. The next climb was Sestriere, not the steepest side of Sestriere, bit of a motorway climb, but by the summit, Froome had a gap of 2 minutes 42, and he carved out another 30 seconds on this descent too, so gained almost a minute and a half on the descents alone. Lopez and Carapaz were passengers in that chasing group. It was Dumoulin, Reichenbach and Pinot doing all the work. On the descent of Sestriere, Ben O'Connor, sadly 12th at the start of the day, crashed heavily and he had to abandon. As Froome began the Jeffro climb up to the finish, he had just more than just a bit more than 3 minutes. Pinot was the guy that emerged on that climb, and he eventually finished 3 minutes 7 down, with Lopez a further 5 seconds down and Dumoulin just behind him at 3:23. So Froome now leads the mountains classification, as well as obviously the overall classification. The big news was that he took the pink jersey, with Yates coming in surrounded by teammates more than 30 minutes down. There was a group even behind him almost 44 minutes down. The time gaps today were enormous. Froome now leads overall by 40 seconds over Dumoulin, with Pinot third at 4:17, but with Lopez breathing down his neck 40 seconds further back. Then come Carapaz and Pozzovivo, who was 11th on the stage but 8.5 minutes down. Rohan Dennis dropped out of the top 10, while George Bennett and Sam Omen both moved up a bit and are both now in the top 10. There were several non-finishers, as well as Aru, Kirianka and O'Connor. There was also Luis Vervec, a teammate at Sunweb of Tom Dumoulin, Michael Scherel, Mirko Maestri and William Bonney. So Daniel, this is a stage that will go down in the record books, as there already comparisons being made with rides by Eddie Merckx, Claudio Chiappucci in this neck of the woods in 1992, went with 125 kilometres to
on
go
his own, on his own with about 125 kilometres to go, and he actually attacked even before that.
So it was it is one of those rides that will just go down. Now the watching it unfold and wondering at the wisdom of the move, you couldn't help. On the climb of the Finestre, the gap was sort of consistently 20 to 40 seconds, really. They were climbing at the same speed, the Dumoulin group behind, and it was on the descent that it opened up. You know, Froome gained about a minute on that descent. Now, what does that say? Does that just tell you that Froome is a very good descender? Does it tell you that the group behind Dumoulin, Pinot and co. Just weren't... I mean, is there any excuse for losing a minute on the descent?
No, and I think that was, well, that was obviously the difference between at that point it coming back together. I mean, I actually thought that Dumoulin did exactly the right thing, I thought at the time, by letting Froome go on the top of the Finestre climb. We'll hear later that Tom Dumoulin actually couldn't follow. He would have liked to follow Chris Froome. But it could have come back together in the valley, and yeah, you would have had a different outcome. Froome has descended well the last 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure whether his was an exceptional descent or Dumoulin's was a poor one. But I think the key thing was that very early in today's race, so from the Finestre, the top half of the Finestre onwards, it was mano a mano. It was one-on-one combat, not just between Dumoulin. Dumoulin got a bit of help, but it was basically individual riders riding against each other. So that the advantage of being in a group was, I wouldn't say negligible, but it wasn't that great. So once the gap had gone out, Froome's gap had gone to 2 minutes and 3 minutes, you know, logic would dictate that a group would be able to catch an individual rider, even if it's a group of four or five riders. However, in reality, I think everyone is so tired now in this Giro that it was one-on-one, basically.
And for a long time, I mean, Sebastian Reichenbach deserves a lot of credit for being in that group and being a very valuable teammate to Thibaut Pinot. But for a long time, it was, you know, Reichenbach, Pinot, Dumoulin, through and off. But a little bit like the day that Simon Yates got away into Sepada with the group chasing behind him, there's always a question mark about just how committed the guys in the chasing group are, because, you know, the guy up front on his own is fully committed, although Froome says that he tried to ride in within himself sufficiently to give him enough to get over the climbs in the valley. But behind, you know, when you're watching Reichenbach basically leading the chase of Chris Froome, you think, well, I'm not that surprised that the lead's not falling.
No, that said, if ever there was a man who had reason to chase down a Team Sky rider, it's Sebastian Reichenbach. Reichenbach, a lot of listeners will remember, was the guy who had a collision, or according to Reichenbach, was kind of pushed off his bike by a Sky rider, Gianni Moscon, in one of the late season races last year. Was it the Giro di Piemonte? It was one of the Italian one-day races in the week of the Tour of Lombardy last year, and that case is still not settled. So we think there's a bit of ill feeling there, and Reichenbach, I think, was certainly committed. But again, you know, everyone is down to their last drops of energy, and I think you're starting to see how hard this Giro really is. I spoke to Mara Venyi, the race director, back in February in Dubai, and around about that time, so not long after the race route had been unveiled, there was a general feeling that it wasn't as intimidating as some Giro routes. He pointed out then that there were 2,000 metres of climbing more than there was last year and the year before. So it was actually, from that point of view, a harder Giro. And I think we're seeing that today. I mean, we've seen that in the time gaps. I mean, I was astonished. I didn't know what happened to Rowan Dennis today, and I went to speak to the BMC press officer and asked how he got on, and was told that he finished. I think he finished 18th on the stage, but he lost 14 minutes. And we were standing at the bottom of the mountain, Rich. We were kind of stuck for a while, weren't we? We'll talk about this again in a minute. But and we were watching groups come through, and the gaps were absolutely huge, weren't they?
They were enormous. Ryan Mullen has tweeted that he was running about 300 watts for 6 hours today and finished 45 minutes behind the winner. It was really a throwback to the old days when, you know, races could explode like that in mountain stages. And, you know, we are nearing the end of a very hard Giro. It was a hard stage, ridden hard from the start. The team's plans were logical to place guys in the break, you know, and I think Matt White said at the start this morning that they would try to get somebody in a break. The one break that looked like it might stick had Sergio Henao and David De La Cruz in it from Team Sky. So they were, that was clearly the plan, to get guys up the road in the break. But and Dave Brailsford told us that, because we bumped into him close to the finish. We were on our way up to the team buses. We got stuck. The police wouldn't let us through, so we were waiting for the race to pass before we could get up to the buses. And a bald figure appeared on a team bike.
It wasn't Lionel.
It was Dave Brailsford on Vasil Kirienko's bike. He had been one of the Team Sky staff members out on the course today, handing out bottles and food and so on.
Not Vasil Kirienko. He packed, hadn't he? Dave Brailsford.
He was on his bike, though. Yeah. So anyway, we grabbed a quick word with Dave Brailsford. But did you see that coming?
Well, we planned for it, I must say, you know, and we spent all day yesterday. I spent most of the day with James Morton, the nutritionist, and with Tim, and we picked the stage apart into what we thought the intensity of each phase would be. We split it into phases, and we looked at a fueling strategy more than anything, because we felt that was going to be the single biggest determining factor of the day. We knew that he'd um, he was getting better. You know, his form was improving. He was better than when he came in and obviously got over the crash. And we thought yesterday there was a few cracks that appeared. And I think that buoyed everybody a little bit and just gave them belief. So we, as you do, you kind of forensically take it apart, plan the stage. And but I must say, having a plan on a spreadsheet and sitting in a bus and talking about some kind of ambitious crackpot plan is one thing, and be able to deliver it like he has is another. Fair play to
him. Well, it's more common tactics to put guys up the road, and I think he had a couple in an early move. That's kind of what we expected, and for him to attack when he did, but to join up with others. Yeah. When he went on his own, was that something you'd consider?
The idea was to, initially, we wanted to try and get people up the road, to get them into the valley, obviously, and we thought other teams would do that. So the first move of the day was pretty good for us, really. But then I think, obviously, Scott used their bigger lads to really ride down a break, and they pushed quite hard there, really. And then then we went into the Col de Finesse, and we knew we had 27 hairpins at the bottom, and that was a great opportunity, really, to really put it on the line. And fair play to you know, Salva, David De La Cruz, Sergio, or both of whom got in a break early doors, and then Kelly Ellison did the performance of his time at Team Sky, really, today. He was there when it mattered. And the idea was to go over the top and try and get some kind of help in a valley. But he didn't want to. He was adamant last night that if he could, you know, if Yates was dropped, and then he could drop Dumoulin on Finest, he didn't want to ride in the valley with him. So he wasn't going to drag him to first place, as it were. So he said, right, if we're in that situation, I'm going to chance my arm and go it alone. And I'm glad he did.
So Brailsford mentioned the plan there. But as Kenny Ellison said earlier on, you know, if he was surprised that Froome went as early as he did, I don't think it was the plan for him to go as far out as that.
No, and this refueling strategy on the Finestre, I mean, any other team that was familiar with the history of this climb, and particularly the memorable first time that the Giro went over this climb. I mentioned Savoldelli earlier, and when Savoldelli won the Giro in 2005, a lot was made the following day of his refueling, rehydration strategy on the Finestre. I think Discovery Channel, the team he was riding for at the time, had five guys positioned at various points on the climb. And this was that fact, and that foresight was attributed with winning the race for Savoldelli. Really, what we don't know, Rich, is whether the other teams had also employed a similar strategy, because, you know, we know better than anyone that in the past Team Sky have not, you know, not necessarily boasted about their innovative approaches and strategies, but they've certainly told us about them. And there is a tendency to think that they're the only ones doing what they're doing, and we don't know whether that's the case. Maybe we'll investigate that tomorrow.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our main sponsor here at the Giro d'Italia, as they are throughout the year. I presented a Rafa Pedler de Charme t-shirt this morning to George Benny. He was delighted. In fact, we should probably hear his reaction. Here he was at the start this morning before what proved a pretty good day for him, actually. I think he'll be quite happy. He was 12th on the stage, and he has moved up, actually, into the top 10. He's 9th overall now. Which I think he'll be quite happy with that. Another hard day tomorrow, but here he was at the start this morning. Our listeners voted you our Pedler de Charme for week 3.
Did they?
For the cycling podcast. Yeah.
Oh,
congratulations!
Thank you very much. It even looks like it's my size.
It should be your size. I'm not sure that it's ironed very well, but
stoked.
George, we saw you attacking again yesterday. You are a rider who, you know, even though you're placed high on GC, you do like to have a go, don't you?
Yeah, it's probably to my own demise at times. It definitely has been the last few days. And it probably started, it's probably more from having the mechanical and the Zonkalon being behind and then having to play catch-up cycling, you know? And it happened the day Yatesy won. and I saw Froome had dropped and I hit out, and then, you know, it was a really bad move in hindsight, and I don't know what I was thinking. And the same again yesterday, you know, it wasn't that I premeditated or I thought, I just found myself attacking, and I look back when I'm watching the bus and go, shit, yeah, then when they kicked over top of me, I had nothing left. So I think it's when you get sort of forced into desperate, you know, it's sort of like it's a bit desperate, and so today I'm reining it in and just letting the course do the damage, and not feel like I'm the one that has to try to drop people and just let people drop themselves.
So that was George Bennett, the New Zealand rider. We are awarding our overall Pedalar de Charme t-shirt tomorrow. There is a poll currently running to find that person.
Saw some controversy about the Pedalar de Charme today. People not happy that the first language of a lot of the nominees is English.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the riders who were nominated were shortlisted, because we had eight shortlisted for the overall one. We're at the mercy of the listeners. Please nominate whoever you like.
Famously, I don't get involved in the Pedalar de Charme.
Famously, you don't. I don't think it's that surprising that an English language podcast gets a higher proportion of English language speakers, because, I mean, we tend to have a lot of them on the podcast because it's easier to interview them in the English language. But, you know, we're very open, more than open, to obviously nominations of other riders.
Talking Pedalars de Charme, Rich, and it's amazing how quickly things move in professional cycling. You know, we're thinking, or we're talking about Simon Yates today, this afternoon, almost as a forgotten man of the Giro. But I think he spoke, he fronted up to the media at the top of the mountain. We were down at the buses. And his teammates also took what was a terrible day and a terrible defeat for him pretty magnanimously, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I spoke to Chris Yule Jensen at the finish, and I have to say, yeah, you know, he's always a good interview, and it was good of him to stop and speak today, because he didn't have to. Here is Chris Yule Jensen at the finish.
No, I don't think anyone expected a day like today, but that cycling can be quite unforgiving and rather unpredictable at times. And yeah,
how did Simon seem last night? Were you confident he could recover from that?
Yeah, Simon seemed fine, confident, you know. And we've all, but yeah, I think the most important thing is to at times like this, it's now you stick together as a team. It's pretty easy to stick together as a team when everything's going right, and no one can fault Simon. He's defended the jersey fantastically the last 14 days. Won three stages, been a complete class act. I think it was obvious to everyone who could hear the crowds. He's been, you know, inspiring to most of the Italian fans. They love him, and so do his teammates.
Did you ride with him most of the stage today?
For a large part of it, and yeah, just might as well just call a spade. It was just a bad day, but he's still a class act, and I think that's really all there is to say about it.
Did he say anything today? I don't imagine he was in a talkative mood.
No, and I think the best thing you can do in a moment like this is just leave him alone. I think it's worse for Simon. I mean, he's put his heart and soul trying to defend the jersey. We've all worked really hard together, and yeah, he's done our jobs a lot easier, that's for sure. And despite him having a bad day today, I think none of us fault his effort, his performance.
It's funny what you say, Daniel, about this things moving on so quickly. A couple of days ago, if you'd read some reports, Simon Yates could have signed a €4 million contract. He may well. He's only 25. You know, he's ridden extremely well here. Chris Yule Jensen said some very nice things about him there. The team has ridden well. They've made the Giro a really exciting race. You know, they've done an awful lot to make the Giro as exciting as it has been, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. And you know, cycling sport is not just about winning and losing; it's about performing. And he has really performed well.
He has, Rich, and it just goes to show yet again, and history, recent history, should have taught us this, that you should never, ever think the Giro is over until the fat soprano sings whatever she sings. Because we've seen this so many times. I mean, going back to just in this century, Cadel Evans in 2002, a couple of days or a few days from the end, got a hunger knock a few kilometres from the from the top of the state of Folgaria and lost, well, he was in the pink jersey, lost the Giro there, Stephen Kreisweig, that was 2 years ago, and even in that same Giro, Esteban Chavez on the penultimate day when Vincenzo Nibali had already gained back a few minutes on Kreuzweg, and then he gained more time back on Chavez, so he turned that round at the last minute. And this happens because the course is so punishing. Consistently, there are more meters of climbing than in the other two Grand Tours, and I think it really starts to show. And the race organisers, RCS and Mauro Vegni, increasingly stack the most punishing climbs and the highest climbs and the toughest stages towards the back of the race, and that's exactly what's happened in this year's edition. And that said, Simon Yates has had a fantastic race. I mean, I said yesterday it's a massive step forward in his career. The result is irrelevant now. The fact is he got within 3 days of winning a Grand Tour, so you know he effectively won a 2.5 week Grand Tour. And I think for a 25-year-old, is he 25 or 26? And I think that is, you know, it's a great place to be in your career at that point. It's different to Kreisweig a couple of years ago. We already thought in his case that might be a chance of a lifetime. I think in Yates's case, there will be other opportunities.
You would think so, and he does seem a strong character mentally, but you know, you mentioned Cadel Evans, and it took him another 9 years to win a Grand Tour, and it became a cross to bear, a problem for him. The pressure of being a nearly man, of having failed at the final hurdle, did seem to weigh on him. He's a very different character. Stephen Kreuzweg as well was at a different stage in his career, and that was perhaps his only chance to win a Grand Tour. And you know, I can't see him winning one now, though. I could be wrong. Simon Yates should have more chances. But you do wonder about the psychological damage inflicted by an experience like today's, when it wasn't like yesterday when he cracked towards the summit and lost a few seconds. This was a collapse, a total collapse. And when we saw him, you know, getting dropped on the Finestre, we knew exactly what was going on. We knew there was no coming back. We knew he was finished.
Yeah, and just on the way that Simon Yates has ridden as well, you know, he had shown no sign of weakness, but he'd also looked very springy, very punchy, very strong throughout. But that started to change yesterday, and we said that once a trend begins in a Grand Tour, then often it's irrevocable. Things continue going in that direction. And I know there are people at Sky who was not scratching their head, but they thought that Yates had ridden a very punchy race, a lot of attacks, a lot of accelerations, and they saw yesterday on Prato Nevoso as a sign that all of those efforts were finally going to catch up with him. And I know that the Finestre is a particular climb with an awful lot of hairpins. I can't remember how many. It's in the 20s or 30s, and you know that was a climb that they could put Yates under a lot of pressure by kind of accelerating out of the hairpins and really just grinding him down.
It was interesting. Brailsford, hindsight is a wonderful thing, obviously, but he was talking about the efforts that Simon Yates made, the strategy that they had in this race, which was to claim time when they could, going into that time trial and have enough of a buffer and then cling on for dear life. That was the plan. Now we can all, hindsight's a wonderful thing, we can all say that maybe that was the wrong plan, but Brailsford did make the point that those efforts, those big efforts that he's made, they do take a big toll, and they take more out of you than a long, steady, gradual effort. Anybody who's done sport knows that. However, that is also Simon Yates' strength, and so it's logical and it makes sense to ride like that.
Well, this is also why I think Tom Dumoulin has ridden a brilliant race, in spite of the difficult position he's in now and his sort of pessimism tonight. I think he is mastering the art of the kind of new art of riding Grand Tours, whereby, you know, it might not be romantic, it might not be spectacular, but you know where your threshold is in terms of watts. And
it's almost like Dumoulin is oblivious to everybody else around him. He's just riding his own race, isn't he?
And that is how Froome has ridden for many years. We've seen him get dropped on at the bottom of climbs for a long time and then come back up. And you know, people sort of shake their head at this. You know, it jars with kind of purist instinct in all of us. But I think that is simply the most efficient way to ride Grand Tours, particularly as they are getting harder and harder and higher and higher and steeper and steeper.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at sciencesport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. And this part, Daniel, we're going to hear from Tom Dumoulin. We're going to hear from Thibaut Pinot as well, who has also, like Dumoulin, ridden what's beginning to look like an excellent race. He's had a few wobbles, but he's a real diesel, as you said earlier. And a big engine is getting better as the race goes on. And, you know, a podium, which he just missed out on a podium last year, podium's now looking likely after Domenico Pozzovivo's attack. We were asked today, actually, by somebody on Twitter, why we haven't really spoken about Pozzovivo very much. We had an interview with Brent Copeland, his manager, a couple of days ago. But it's true that, you know, even at the start this morning, Fabio Aru got big cheers, huge reception. Aru climbed off. I actually caught a glimpse of Aru, of his face, as he rode along at the start, and he got big cheers. And I just saw a sort of glimpse, sort of behind the mask, as it were, because I could see that he was uncomfortable with that adulation when he clearly not himself and not on form. And it was quite sad, actually. I felt a little bit sorry for him in that moment. And the next thing I heard, he'd pulled out the Giro. A lot of pressure on him, a lot of expectation on him today. But we were... What was I talking about there? Sorry.
A couple of riders abandoned today, didn't they, Rich? Well,
Vasyl Kiryienka, Ben O'Connor.
Ben O'Connor, who we've spoken to on a couple of occasions, very promising young Australian climber. He was riding pretty high.
This is actually difficult because I was going to talk about Pozzovivo and we've been completely sidelined. But anyway,
well, he was
by myself.
Ben O'Connor was riding very high on general classification, wasn't he, Rich? So much so that I spotted the Dimension Data chief, Doug Ryder, at the start today, and I thought I'd go and have a word with him about Ben O'Connor.
Yeah, I mean, Ben, first Grand Tour, so, you know, he's done incredibly well and rode well in Catalunya and well in some races, and we were, you know, knew he's got great potential, and we were thinking, you know, it'll be amazing to have him support Louis Mankies in the mountains, knowing that he can go deep, not knowing how long he would survive in a Grand Tour. You know, the first week to 10 days, we thought he would be exceptional like he has been, and then, you know, then I guess... You know, in support of Louis, but I mean, he's been phenomenal. You know, he's continued to ride really well, and with 3 days to go in the Giro d'Italia, he's still right up there, you know, looking really, really good and comfortable. He is tired, sure, but I mean, you know, a guy like that in his first Grand Tour, you know, the possibilities for the future for him in cycling is unbelievable. So, yeah, we're very, very happy for him and of course for our team.
So at this point, however these last couple of mountain stages go, he's on some kind of career plan for the major tours, I imagine, like right from when this Giro finishes.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think for him, you know, in his future in the Tour de France, young riders jersey, I mean, he's got a hugely bright future. I mean, he's, you know, he's still so young. So, yeah, I think he's shown his Grand Tour potential, and I guess he'll win smaller stage races or shorter stage races in his career in time, and we'll focus on that going forwards in Austria, etc. But I mean, going, you know, for 2019, 2020, he's for sure a guy that will go to the Tour de France and set the race on fire, I'm sure.
So that was Doug Ryder, Pozzovivo, Daniel Pozzovivo. What I was trying to say earlier, and I forgot what I was saying midway through saying it, was that Aru got a much bigger reception than Pozzovivo this morning, even though Pozzovivo was looking this morning like a good bet for the podium. And it is true that Pozzovivo does not get the attention that other riders get when, you know, he's got solid results, nothing spectacular. He's not got many major wins to his name. But he is one of these riders who, he doesn't look particularly pretty on a bike, That's an understatement, I think. He looks like a frog a little bit with his sticky outy leg, and you know, it's just not very pleasant to watch. Is that a reason, perhaps? I don't know, but he's not somebody who really gets the headline writers excited.
Clever lad, a university graduate, plays the piano, keen meteorologist.
Changed his name, didn't he?
Changed his name from Puzzovivo when he was very young, when he was about 19 or 20. Puzzovivo meaning I smell lively, or I stink. Yeah, you would change it, wouldn't you? Now it means lively well, a well as in, you know, watering well.
Anyway, he had a bad day today, and finally we've spoken about him when he's crashed out of the top three, as Brent Copeland sort of feared.
Old Patrick Conrad had a good day, didn't he? Haribo's Patrick Conrad. Haribo and Bora Hansgrohe's Patrick Conrad.
He did indeed. He's eighth overall, so very solid indeed. He was actually ninth on the stage.
Rich, can I go off on a brief, very brief tangent?
Yeah.
We are in Bardonecchia, and that is the foot, at the foot of a climb called the Col de Sommelier. Now, what's a sommelier?
Somebody who knows their wine.
Yeah, not you, basically. It's a wine waiter. We'll talk about our wine from last night in a second. However, Col de Sommelier is one of the highest roads in Europe, about 2,990 metres. It is the holy grail of high alpine passes, but unfortunately it's not paved and the surface is slightly worse than the Colle delle Finestre. But one day I hope the Giro will go over the Col de Sommelier from Bardonecchia. That was a tangent, wasn't it? What about our wine last night? What do you think of it? It was La Luna e Falò, which is also the title of a book by Cesare Pavese, the most famous author from this region, and means that the moon and the bonfires, and it was very nice. It was a Barbera d'Asti. What did you think of it? Nice?
Do you want my tasting notes? Yeah. Do you want my tasting notes? It was all right. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Okay. Back to the race.
went down well. Back to the race. Well, we should hear from Tom Dumoulin because you spoke to him at the finish. Before we do, I mean, you mentioned right at the start the scepticism that might come with Froome's performance today. And front and centre once again is the adverse analytical finding, the salbutamol case that is unresolved. Yeah, it's something that we were concerned about, everybody was concerned about coming into the Giro, and then as he slipped down the overall standings, less bothered about it. Now we're bothered about it again. I expect there'll be a lot of chat about that over the next few days, especially if Froome wins this Giro. I mean, we should be consistently concerned or not concerned about it, I suppose. It doesn't really, it's immaterial how he's doing in the race. You know, he'll say what he said all along, that he has every right to be here, that he's done nothing wrong, and that he is entitled to due process, and that enables him to be here.
Yeah, the result, perversely, we've got a situation in professional cycling now where the better you perform, the worse, or the greater the scrutiny you're under and the worse it looks, in a way. I mean, this is a good opportunity now, Rick, to hear from Laurens ten Dam, actually, because we're going to talk a little bit more about Sunweb. And Laurens ten Dam, you won't hear it here, but to our Dutch colleagues, he said it. Froome's ride today was like something out of the 1980s. It was like Eddie Merckx. I said to him, well, Eddie Merckx did not ride in the 1980s, Laurens. He said, oh, yeah. Anyway, this is what he also said at the finish about Tom Dumoulin's performance and Froome's.
Yeah, we started that climb at the 90k from the finish, so I think so, yeah. So, man-to-man fight with 100k, more or less, a little less, so crazy.
And I guess the first half of the stage went exactly as the team wanted. I mean, how do you judge the second half of the stage and the result?
Yeah, so first half, we wanted people in a break. I was there. Took a lot of energy out of me, and then also a lot of energy out of the Mitchelton Scott team, I guess, to chase us. If I was them, I would have let us go, but yeah, no, I don't know. But then at the end, yeah, the second half was just man to man. I don't know anything anymore from the first K on the Finestre, because I was dropping, and it's crazy. I just passed the finish line half an hour down, and I heard that only 32 guys in the on the finish. So that means, like, yeah, it's really like the old school racing, and I think this Giro has been hard. The second week we raced like maniacs, and you see what the result is now.
How do you find 40 seconds tomorrow?
Go 40 seconds faster. That's Froome up the hill. I don't know. You know, the day after Saint-Colin, he also had a less day. So there he lost actually 1 minute or something. So you never know.
So that was Laurence Ten Dam, who is a teammate of Tom Dumoulin here. Worth mentioning his other young teammate, Sam Oman, who is riding extremely well and is 10th overall now. He's now climbed into the top 10. You know, his main job here is to help Tom Dumoulin, and I imagine that he was unhappy not to be with Dumoulin when he most needed him today. But for himself, and he's been doing a lot for him, for himself. It's a very good rider. He's a very promising young rider.
Yes, Rich. Dumoulin himself, I felt, was very disappointed, downbeat, pessimistic, upset that he hadn't had more work from Pino and Carapaz and Superman Lopez. And
which, watching it, I can understand Carapaz and Lopez didn't do anything, but Pino and Reichenbach did seem to be as committed as he was, I think.
Yeah, certainly in phases, I think. And it's just the way it works, isn't it? But he was. I think there have been a few days now where Pino in particular has been on his wheel, and I haven't really sensed there's any particularly ill feeling, and Dumoulin has not been pointing the finger directly at Pino, but it has happened on a couple of occasions now.
But do you remember last year, it was exactly the same with Dumoulin. He is one to point the finger, you know, and last year it was Nibali and Quintana. There were days when he would finish and he would be unhappy at, you know, the failure of some of his rivals to help him, essentially. And on exactly the same stage last year, with the same amount of days to go, albeit a time trial last year, not this year, he was in the same position. He lost the pink jersey on this very day, a stage that Mika Landa won. Quintana took over the pink jersey. And it was the following day, which was a stage that Thibaut Pinot won, where Dumoulin saved the jersey with some help from Adam Yates and Bob Jungels in particular. It's different this year because there isn't a time trial to finish things off. So he's on the back foot, whereas last year you could argue that he was still in the virtual pink jersey. Though he did seem, I mean, I was casting my mind back, and he seemed as downbeat on the equivalent day last year as he is this year. Shall we hear from him?
Let's hear just how downbeat he sounded.
Yeah, crazy stage. I expected Sky to go on a Finestra, and they did. I didn't have the legs to follow. I had good legs, I think. I did everything right, and Froome was way too strong.
Do you expect more collaboration for the other teammates?
I expect nothing anymore. It was mostly up to me, of course, to chase, but I would have liked some help, but yeah, they decided not to do that, and I can understand. At the moment, I'm a little bit pessimistic, but we will see when I wake up tomorrow.
Hear a little cameo from Chiro in that clip of Dumoulin, Rich?
Yeah, I did.
Not with us tonight, though, is he?
Sadly not.
Scarpered to the press room. So, Tom Dumoulin's got to find these 40 seconds tomorrow at Cervinia. It's a climb that really should suit him because it's not particularly steep. I think Ryder Heisdal rode pretty well there in 2012, and it's a similar kind of rider. Also, there's a precedent for a rider turning the Giro around and killing a giant, slaying a giant on Cervinia. The giant in question was Pavel Tonkov in 1997. The master, the monster, Pavel Tonkov, and Ivan Gotti took the pink jersey off Tonkov at Cervinia in 1997 and never relinquished it. So, who knows?
Well, you talked last night about trends, Daniel, and the trend now appears to be that Froome is resurgent and Dumoulin is just still riding his own race. I've got the sense throughout this year that, apart from the opening day in Jerusalem, actually, that Dumoulin has been in sort of fourth gear, going occasionally into fifth gear. I haven't felt that he's been on top of it in the same way that he was last year. That there could be all kinds of facts in that. It could be the climbing this year. It could be the position that he's in as challenger rather than favourite. There's a bit more pressure on him. I don't know, but I think his time trial result the other day was evidence that he's not quite pinging, I don't think. And if he was, I think that on the stage of Zapata, we'd have seen him chasing Simon Yates a bit more effectively. And I think today we'd have seen him chasing Chris Froome a bit more effectively. The question now is the momentum all with Chris Froome, or will today have taken too much out of him? He will have put in a huge effort today. Can he recover for another hard day tomorrow? And you know, we expect Dumoulin to just ride again at his pace that he rides at and not falter from that.
Well, this sounds like a good opportunity, Rich, to hear from Thibaut Pinot, because precisely what you said about Chris Froome having suffered after the Zonkerland stage and not having recovered the next day, could history repeat itself tomorrow at Chervinia? This is what Thibaut Pinot said.
La plus folle, en tout cas. C'était une journée incroyable. C'est vrai que ça marquera, je pense, l'histoire du Giro.
I don't know if it was my best day on the Giro, but it was certainly the craziest. I think it'll go down in Giro history because it was totally insane. I also felt pretty good, and I had a fantastic Sebastian Reichenbach at my side. If I'm in the podium positions tonight, it's really thanks to him. I couldn't go with Froome when he attacked at the top of the Finestre. I was just happy to be where I was after three or four really hard days. I was pleased, and I also had to save energy because Dumoulin and Froome are definitely the strongest riders in the Giro, and my goal is the podium. I don't know if Froome can still be beaten tomorrow. He could be a bit weaker, like he was after the Zonkerland, but then everyone's really given a lot. We're really tired tonight, and tomorrow we've got another 220 kilometres, so I'm not sure how we're going to do it. We're all as tired as each other.
Ouais, pour l'instant, on sait pas trop comment on va les faire parce que c'est, on est vraiment fatigué, mais c'est pareil pour tout le monde.
So, Rich, that was Pino saying that it's not over. It's going to be hard. I mean, what do you do tomorrow? We've got three big climbs. We've got two first category climbs before the first category climb, so the third first category climb of the day to Chervinia. Both very difficult. The first one is called, I don't know what language the local names are in here. I don't know whether it's Occitan, but Col...
Dutch?
He
struggled with Dutch.
Col Ciscor, I'm going to say in French because we're kind of in getting towards the Val d'Aosta where they start to speak French. And then the Col Saint-Pantaleon. Both hard, not particularly high, 1623 metres, 1664 metres. But do you, if you're Dumoulin, do you have a look and try to stir things up on those climbs, or do you at 3 kilometres from the finish tomorrow just go nuclear and just give it a big old hoik and try to find 30 seconds in the hope that your team's been able to control the stage before that, there isn't a break down the road and there are a further 10 seconds and bonus seconds up for grabs?
There is a clear imbalance in the teams, you know, and we've seen Sky do this so many times. He is a team that is more than able to control things tomorrow, albeit they've lost Vasyl Kiryanka, but still a very strong team with clearly some riders going very well. So they're now in defence mode, aren't they? And they just have to ride on the front. And we heard the other day in the Simon Yates press conference when he was asked why he was able to attack and gain time here. We don't see that so much at the Tour de France. He said it's because at the Tour de France you've often got Team Sky riding tempo on the front and not allowing people to ride. Now, if someone had a stronger team, they could do that and perhaps shed some of Froome's teammates and try to isolate him. But good luck with that, really. I don't see that happening. So it's a really difficult one from Tom Dumoulin. For him to be... If it was the other way around and he was 40 seconds ahead, it'd be a far more... simple proposition for him to claim back that time. He's going to have to hope that Froome has dug so deep today that he does suffer tomorrow. And his form has been very erratic here. You know, he won at Mont-Zonkerland and paid for the next day to Zapata, let's not forget. And, you know, that stage he got dropped when we didn't expect to see that. We thought Zonkerland was the confirmation that Froome was back. The next day he really struggled, and the theory at the time was that he dug too deep on the Zonkerland. He certainly dug deep today, so will he pay for that tomorrow?
Was Tom Dumoulin eating his kiwi fruit after today's stage? I didn't see him eating his kiwi fruit, and this worries me because we talked about this yesterday.
Some people messaged us about that, saying that the potassium was perhaps the reason why he's having, certainly I know potassium is in bananas, obviously in kiwi as well, apparently.
Well, I spoke to his coach Hendrik Werner this morning about the kiwi fruit issue, and he said it wasn't his area, and he seemed he was quite, when I informed him that Tom had been seen on several occasions tucking into some kiwi fruit from a Tupperware box after the stage, he seemed quite alarmed.
Don't have to test positive for potassium. Is that a prohibited substance or controlled?
Do you know which country is the world's biggest producer of kiwi fruits? Biggest grower of kiwi fruits?
Peru.
Italy.
Really?
True story.
Well,
I'm good at this. I know a lot of it. You can ask me... Can you ask me which country is the biggest producer of a lot of fruits, and I'll know the answer. But let's not get into that tonight.
Plums.
Talking of
plums.
Fruits. Talking of fruits.
Plums.
Give me
something easier.
Yeah. No, talking of fruits. Gianni Savio talks about fruits in our Kilometer Zero.
Fruits.
I like very much the fruits. Here's a little trailer from our Kilometer Zero 40 pista from Gianni Savio.
So my philosophy is to honor the race, to be protagonist, always to attack, to be present in breakaway.
Gianni Savio is an iconic figure of cycling, the most elegant, charm and classy manager of cycling. And if you want to know how to dress, always in order, never mai un cappello fuori posto.
Never hair out of place.
Savio. I've seen him for probably 30 years. A great guy, actually. I'd say somebody what loves cycling and has done a lot of good things for bike riders. He's a great character. I think he loves himself a lot. Yeah, Savio.
My big passion is generally sport. I am a sportman, and so I think that it's impossible for me to think something without sport.
That was the inimitable Gianni Savio, the latest Kilometer Zero, and the last one from the Giro, number 9, and it's available to friends of the podcast. If you're not already a friend, do sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thank goodness we released that Simon Yates one on Wednesday rather than keeping it until Friday. Anyway, there's 9 episodes there, all taking a sideways look at the race and at Italy and various aspects of the Giro. It's £15 for the year. Lots more to come, including actually a recording of a live show that we recently did in Hackney in London. And that will be released very soon also for friends of the podcast. Almost forgotten we had that, but there you go. Daniel, we should wrap things up.
We should, Rich. We need to find our car. We need to locate the press room. We need to find our hotel. We need to get you some wine. We need to record your tasting notes.
Let's go.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa. Ci gira nella tenevo giardina che la raccolgo l'acqua e lo vino.